Hi friends, my name is Chidima, also known as the Type A Hippie, and forgive my voice. Things have been rough for the last couple weeks in terms of that, but enough about that. I am so excited. I am here with a dear friend, Christine Watson, and we ran into each other, or our paths crossed, because we have a passion and purpose for providing support and resources for survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. And so, Christine, I'm so glad that you are here with me. She's actually here with me, which is super cool. So welcome.
Thank you, Chidima. I'm very excited about being here.
Awesome. So this is the Type A Hippie podcast, SheCast episode 20. And so we're just going to have a conversation, friends, about domestic violence and sexual assault. I remember one of the first times Christine and I talked, and we were just talking about how it's so important to change the conversation around these two issues that are really mingled, and they're really related pretty well. And that's one of the reasons I started the podcast in the first place, was because I was actually quite tired of hearing some of the same questions specifically about those two issues. And I'll defer to you because you have a lot more experience with that. But I guess we can start with, how did you kind of find your way to this realm of being of service to humanity? And then I definitely want to hear the questions you absolutely despise here.
I think that's a good place to start, and that is a very good question. I have a master's degree in English literature, English and American literature actually, which seems a bit far removed from what I do on a day-to-day basis. But when I left university, I needed a job, and So I started temping for an agency that provided services to refugees and asylum seekers. This was in England. And all of a sudden, I found myself kind of working in a world where, yes, it was providing services to humanity. I like how you phrased that. But it really just opened my eyes to the prejudices that certain populations face.
Absolutely.
And I did that for a couple of years, and then moved to America and knew straight away that I had to continue that work, and I had to continue doing some kind of advocacy for marginalized people.
Mm-hmm. That's so awesome. I love that, especially with what's going on around us, right? There's so many people that feel like they have no voice, and I really feel similar to you. I think it's not surprising that the divine allowed our paths to cross, and I'm super grateful that that happened, because many like-minded people tend to gravitate towards each other, especially when I may not have a voice in some arenas, but I do have a voice in others, and so I feel like it's my job to speak up for and speak out against discrimination and anything that further marginalizes or others people, right? Because there's so many people, like, it doesn't feel good to be an other or to be silenced or to not feel like you have a voice. And so that's one of the things that my friends and I, we actually started, I'll let you know about this, a social justice book club that's starting in February.
Oh, that's cool.
And so one of those things is that we are reading from authors that have been marginalized, and so we want to help amplify the voice, and we all can learn something, right? It's a bad day when I've learned absolutely nothing.
No, right. I would agree.
So, okay, so you were saying that you came over to this country and you realized that you wanted to do stuff with marginalized people. So walk us through if you, or how you got to specifically sexual assault and domestic violence.
I had worked a little bit on women's issues when I was working with refugees and asylum seekers, and had come into contact with a lot of survivors. Mm-hmm. And it was clear to me that survivors are everywhere.
Sure.
And it just kind of piqued my interest, for want of a better way to put it, and it felt like a very worthy I don't want to say cause, because that sounds wrong.
Totally.
But a mission. And so it was important to me that I could reconnect with that when I came to this area, and kind of finding out what was available, what resources were available, but certainly what kind of supportive agencies were available. And that's how I ended up doing the work that I do now.
That's awesome. Yeah, there are quite a bit of resources in different arenas that people are generally not privy to. They don't even know that it exists. And I always get the best compliment when people say that I should be a social worker instead of going to med school, because social workers, the ones that I've come across, have been some of my favorite human beings, because their hearts are so large and they often go above and beyond for humanity and just wanting to be helpful and provide people the resources, especially when they aren't aware that those resources exist. So I started with having a desire as well to work with survivors, because I had come across in another role in the medical field where someone had experienced a sexual assault. And I had heard from them that they felt empowered when they spoke with a rape advocate. And that was the verbiage or the terminology. That was the name of the role. And then over the summer, when the Stanford student or former Stanford student, who is a rapist, I'm going to call him what he is, caught in the act by two brave graduate students, when I realized that he had only gotten several months in incarceration, I was fuming. And I decided, because I was living in California at the time, I was in a pre-med post-bac program, I decided that I was going to, I was going to start doing this kind of work once I came back to Michigan. And I'm so glad that I, just doing a simple internet search, I kind of found an organization that seemed to fit those needs. And I ended up doing some work and advocacy around sexual assault and domestic violence, because I wanted to help people, in their darkest hour, because that's generally what it is for people. It's not a fun time. It's not, anything like that from what I gather. And so for me, it was really important to participate in this area amongst a couple others and change the conversation. So speaking of conversation, I'm sure this comes up in conversation. So what are questions that we should just ban, Christine? What are some of the things that we should, as a society, not ask when it comes to domestic violence or sexual assault?
There's a long list, unfortunately, but I think one of the top ones has to be, why don't they leave?
Sure.
And I think a lot of people struggle with that question, and they struggle with the answer to that question, because it's not an easy one. And I should say, I've been in the social services field for almost 15 years now, 11 years predominantly working with survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence, and it still makes me cringe. Yeah. Every single time I hear that, and it's one of those things where it's going to come up when somebody asks you, what do you do for a living?
Sure.
And you start to explain to them, that's ultimately the question that they're going to ask. I take that as a learning opportunity, an education opportunity. And I think, kind of going back to a little bit what you were saying, that what inspired you and kind of pushed you to engage in the way that you're engaging now. I think that's the kind of, we need that in this movement. We need people to hear something, see something, and then become involved. So I just wanted to say that I really appreciate that, because we need more people like that. And the Stanford case, I think, is a good example, unfortunately, of some of the failings that we as a society put forward to our survivors. But I think, why doesn't she stay? And I'm going to use gendered language due to the statistics, so right. I don't mean to offend anybody, but that's always the question that comes up, why do they stay?
Right.
And anybody who works with survivors will be able to answer that question.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different reasons. There's a lot of barriers to survivors for leaving. It could be something as simple as financial. It could be something as simple as logistical. Maybe they don't have another place to go. We don't all have family members who can take us in.
Yep.
We don't all have family members who can financially support us. We don't necessarily have access to health care, and who knows where that's going to end up these days.
And Christine, we know that statistically, a survivor is more likely to lose their life when leaving, right?
Yes. So there's a lot of safety concerns involved. I think a lot of people don't understand that sometimes survivors have to make the safest choice. And as crazy as it may sound to other people, the safest choice is actually staying.
Sure.
Because it keeps them and their children alive.
Right. And they know their situation. Like, I loved when I went through my own training, so much so that I'm actually going to pass it along to our learning and development team where I work, because there are so many nuances, and I loved the idea of their survivor knows their life better than anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, there's definitely advantage to being an outside party, you know, an objective person to kind of shed light into other people's lives. Not specific, like, so I say that in general, just human being to human being, like as a friend, there's definitely value. I can talk to one of my girlfriends and say, okay, I'm going to take myself out of the picture. What do you see? There's value in that. Now, working with a survivor, there may be some limited value, but one thing that I love about where I am as a, in volunteering is that I don't really have to involve myself into the lives of the survivor. My role is really simple. It's to provide support, right? And to provide information so that they have informed consent so they can make a decision that works best for themselves and their family. And so I don't need to insert myself personally into the matter. So that takes a lot of pressure. So if you are, I guess this is a good place as any to say it, if you are interested in doing this work, which it's not easy work, friends, but it is so valuable and it is so rewarding. I sometimes do feel a little selfish for having found something that I feel so rewarded by. You do not have to be a survivor. You are likely a survivor of something. You do not have to be a survivor of sexual assault or domestic violence to add value to a team, because it's not really about you. Yes, you come to the table and you're amazing and your heart is huge. That's probably one of the reasons you're interested and it piqued your interest. That said, you don't have to have personally experienced anything that someone you're working with has experienced, which is a beautiful thing, because then you can leave any of your own preconceived ideas, notions, and simply be present to come alongside them as someone's just that's providing resources and support, and it's really that simple. So what's another question, Christine?
Well, and I would say I definitely agree with that. And I think, as you were saying very eloquently, that, you know, survivors are experts in their own situation. So who am I to go in and tell them what's best for them? And I think also to recognize that survivors understand their situation,
right,
and a lot of times understand what needs to happen. They may just not be in a position where they can make that happen.
Sure.
And so you're right. We come in to help them with that. But it's an assistance. It's not a force. And I think that's really important. And I think that is another question that comes up a lot is, how do we make somebody leave? Or how do we make a situation better? Well, we don't. And I think even for survivors, that's a question that comes up a lot, that we have to acknowledge and realize we're not in control ultimately of other people's behaviors.
Right.
We can't fix another person's behavior. As a society, we can hold people accountable.
Sure.
But we can't make somebody do something, whether it's being a batterer or it's being a survivor. Because certainly for a survivor, that choice is not there.
Right.
So I think in a roundabout way to answer your question, I think there's also just a lot of misinformation yes. out there. And I think that perpetuates some of the issues that we see and some of the barriers that survivors face.
Yeah. So what is something, you're mentioning misinformation, do you mean something like, something that I've heard, you know, that maybe she, and I'm also using gendered language because of what the statistics show. And one good thing that I appreciate, though, with the organization that I'm affiliated, that we help survivors of all genders.
Yes.
So that is not a barrier to getting help if you need help, if you're a survivor. So misinformation, This happens, friends. Humble beginnings. I didn't bring my notebook again. So you were talking about misinformation, and it made me think about something. It'll come back.
I think, if I may interject, I think mm-hmm. when I talk about misinformation, it's also centered around the fact that people don't have good understanding of, like I said, of the reality of the barriers. And I think there are a lot of prejudices that gets brought into this. And I think understanding where culture plays into it and how gender biases plays into it, most of service providers in certainly in Michigan, but I would say across America, are open to survivors of all gender. But people have sometimes these misconceptions about domestic violence or sexual assault cannot happen in same-sex relationships.
Sure.
Because, yes, we're using gendered language because of the statistics, but that doesn't mean that it's only a gendered crime.
Sure.
And I think that's where people get stuck sometimes. So I think that's part of that misinformation, that people attribute domestic violence and sexual assault to race. They attribute it
that's
to
right.
gender.
And class,
very much so class. I think mm-hmm. that is again, one of those questions that I get asked a lot in terms of, does this only happen to poor, uneducated people? No.
Not at all.
It does not. It happens to everybody. Statistically speaking, 1 in 4 women will experience sexual assault and or domestic violence. So if you're sitting in a room right now, look around you. And you are with somebody.
Sure.
Statistically speaking. And they look like anybody looks like. And I think that is, I can get on my soapbox about that.
It's
you can hear, my voice is getting, it's going
good.
There. Because it's frustrating to me that people have this notion of what does a survivor look like. They look like somebody who's been beaten up with a black eye, like lying in a hospital bed. And no, they don't.
Not always, yeah.
They look like whoever is standing next mm-hmm. to you in the grocery line.
That's right. Well, and I mean, to your point, so I think one of the things is that there's so much stigma, right, attached to sexual assault and domestic violence. And it's no wonder when you look at the criminal legal system, right? When a man, let's call it what it is, because I was so enraged when I kept hearing this kid, and I was like, no, I believe he was 20 or 21, that's an adult, and that was sexual assault, period, end of story. And so there, you know, when you get a case that's so black and white, and the punishment is very little in light of what that man did to that woman and what he took from her, it's no wonder that more people, like, I can understand why more people don't report the crime.
Yes.
Because stigma, when I think of stigma, I think of silence, right? To our earlier point about speaking up for the voiceless. When there's significant stigma attached to something, many people don't feel comfortable talking about it because it's embarrassing or they think it's their fault. And the truth is, it's not a survivor's fault. Whether they stay or whether they leave, it's not their fault. It's the batterer's fault. It's the sexual predator's fault. It's the person who perpetrated the crime's fault. It's not the person that was the victim or the survivor of the crime. And so when we're talking about these issues in particular, the stigma is something that really resonates with me because that has caused so many problems and it plays into the myths and the flat out falsehoods and the lies, you know, that I hear a lot of times. I hear, well, what was she wearing? Or was she inebriated? Or was she drunk or high? And I'm like, well, that has nothing to do with anything. And I don't, I generally don't even answer those questions. I just say that this is why we're friends. I'm like, that is not the point at all. And so let me redirect you and help you understand why that is a very poor question to ask. So please don't ever ask anyone that question again. And so I'll tell you, friends, why that's not a great question. Because it doesn't really matter what the survivor was doing or wearing or where she was at all, because the perpetrator decided to perpetrate a crime against that person. I've been using the hashtag no means no. Consent is real. I posted on Facebook recently about some Kenyan grandmothers who are learning self-defense to fight against potential sexual predators, because these sexual predators are attempting to rape these women, these older women, thinking that they are not, they don't have HIV/AIDS, which is not even necessarily true. And it leads to a much larger discussion. Like, it's mind-boggling to me that that would be the reason why you think that it's acceptable to force yourself on someone sexually and commit a crime. And so these grandmas, who are heroes, quite honestly, are like kicking the crap out of these, you know, dummies and stuff like that, and doing what they feel they need to do to empower themselves so that they can take care of themselves. God forbid the situation presents itself to them. I was gonna ask you about, oh yes, we'll come to that. We'll come back to the federal funding that's being pulled away from.
Well, and let me, because you mentioned a couple of points in terms of the judicial process, and I think the judicial process is so very important when we're talking about domestic violence and sexual assault, as I said before, because we have to hold people accountable. That doesn't mean that that's the only way to hold people accountable, but it's a start. I think, unfortunately, what we are finding is that the judicial system is not very victim-friendly.
Correct.
Because it kind of mirrors the fact that, as a society, we are very victim-focused versus offender-focused.
Sure.
Kind of going back of what you just said, that people automatically will ask questions about the victim versus, why was the perpetrator doing what they were doing?
Right.
We tend to look at the victim to try to find, there must be a reason, there must have been something that the victim did that provoked or, you know, sparked this kind of behavior. And I think until we can change that conversation and change that focus, we're not really going to be successful in ending this violence against anybody.
Right.
And I think that's where we struggle the most. So, for instance, the Stanford case, I thought was very important as part of a movement that's trying to have conversations, because it started a lot of conversations.
It did.
But it did also, I mean, it brought out the stigma. It brought out people on both sides. I so appreciated the fact that the victim was courageous and brave enough to release her victim impact statement.
Absolutely.
And that's a tool that we can use, because I thought it was a very, very powerful statement.
Yeah.
A lot of our survivors don't come forward. A lot of rapes, a lot of abuse are not reported because people know that they're not going to be believed.
Right.
And I feel that as a society and as a community, we should be ashamed of that.
Yes.
There is actually a big national campaign that's called Start By Believing. And I'm glad it's there, and it's trying to hold communities accountable, and actually our local community is part of. We have pledged to be a Start By Believing community, which basically just means that when somebody comes to you and discloses that they have been abused, we start by believing them. It's great that it's there. I think it's super sad that it's there as well.
Totally.
And the fact that we have to say to people, I need to start by believing you. If somebody mugged you and you went to tell your best friend, they're going to be offender focused, not you focused.
Yep.
And we need to change that.
Yeah, no, it's so true. And it's like, it's similar to substance use disorder. So that's a cause of mine as well. And I've had a lot of guests on the podcast to talk about that. There's significant stigma around that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that's interesting to me is a lot of people blame people that are struggling with substance use disorder. So friends, if you haven't listened to the podcast long, it is alcoholism addiction. When someone has cancer, no one blames them, with the exception, the one exception that I've found is lung cancer.
That is true.
Where people do ask, did they smoke? Which I think is a horrible question to ask personally, because at this point it doesn't really matter because they have lung cancer. That said, most other people, when you say, I've recently been diagnosed with cancer, people feel such great sorrow for you and they come alongside you, and you might end up having casseroles for weeks on end, right? People coming to clean your house, and there's significant sympathy around that. Whereas with substance use disorder, which has been proven by providers and by scientists that it's a disorder and that it's a disease, and when it's treated like a disease, like a chronic illness,
yes,
people recover, right? And so kind of changing these conversations, that is one of the things that I was created and put on this planet to do. And I'm really grateful that I realized that, regardless of how long it took, you know, it just kind of came to me, and I'm glad to be here. So I want to talk about something that I posted on Facebook. So I've been a posting political patriot the last several days, and I feel good about it because it's empowering people. I've never been one to call my senators, and I've called them a lot. I've tweeted them, I've emailed them, because I feel really impassioned, and I feel that I need to do something. I can't sit back and complain. I need to get in there and roll up my sleeves and do something. So one thing I posted, and I always start my political posts the same way, and I say, wait and see, they said. Okay, well, here we are. And so one of the things that I posted was that there's funding being pulled away from, and fill in the blanks for me, Christine, because it's related to women and violence, correct?
So there is something called the Violence Against Women's Act, which was actually kind of pushed forward by our former Vice President Joe Biden, who
sure.
had a big passion for women's rights, as well as a lot of other great causes and missions. So in the 90s, he helped to make sure that funding was set up
sure.
for agencies that could provide direct services. And not just domestic violence and sexual assault agencies. The money can also go to states. They can go to all kinds of different places. It's a huge funding source for a lot of people, a lot of agencies across
sure.
America. And yeah, right now what is being told is that may be on the chopping block, which is obviously deeply concerning,
sure.
Considering that, you know, as a movement, our mission is to end violence. And I don't think we have done that yet.
Right.
So the fact that they seem to think that we don't need the money to move forward is very troubling.
Yeah, it is very concerning, especially because, to your point, we haven't completed the mission, right?
No.
Like, it would be one thing if we could say with a straight face that this is not happening anymore. I mean, every time I'm on call with the nonprofit that I work with, I always, at the end, especially if I've gotten calls, I'm always like, I really wish we didn't exist. Because people hurt one another, right?
Yes.
And then, so in one moment I say that, the next moment is I'm so grateful that we exist, because, I mean, I couldn't even imagine what would happen if we did not exist, you know. And it's just not just this organization, it's organizations like this across the country where people can call a number, you know, and get, whether it's counseling, whether it's someone that will help them navigate the clinical, the criminal, the legal system, the civil system, you know, someone that can help them with a restraining order or a PPO. Are they called a TPO, right?
In the state of Michigan, we call them personal protection orders.
Okay, so PPO. Okay, perfect. I was right. You know, someone that can help with maybe temporary shelter. So many different things, and all of this stuff costs money. Like one of my friends, we have so many similarities and then we have differences. And one of the differences is where we align ourselves politically. So we didn't vote for the same I don't think we've ever voted for the same person. But we still have a deep love and respect for one another, and we can have conversations. And so one of her points is always like, who's going to pay for this, you know? And it's a great question, because I'm kind of like, oh, we should take care of everyone, you know, like help everyone. But I get the point of who's going to pay for this. And when we have funding, whether it's through grants or federal funding, it is, that's how we're going to pay for it, you know. And so when that money is gone, then we're not able to pay for the things that we need. And this is a community issue. Like one of the things that I've been posting a lot, and you tell me what you feel about it as well. Like these are human rights issues. Like they're, and just because maybe it doesn't affect me personally or someone in my family personally, doesn't mean that I get to turn a blind eye to it until something affects me personally. And then I want to shout about it. I'm shouting about it now because it's unacceptable to me as a human being. It's unconscionable to me as a human being. And I can't afford to say, oh, well, it doesn't really concern me. I'm so sorry that you're going through that. I wish you well, and I'll keep you in my prayers. That's my favorite. And then, like, turn around and, you know, go drink my kombucha or my latte or my whatever, right?
I think that is part of that conversation of continuing to to reinforce the idea that this is a community issue, and it takes a community coordinated response in order to address it. And I understand too that money has to come from somewhere.
Totally.
And I have to, you know, maybe explain that I may be a little bit biased. I grew up in Northern Europe from a welfare state. So I was brought up to pay for my neighbor. And I understand that for some people that's a foreign concept. And I understand the implications of that. Absolutely. But I think to me, when a government starts to say this is not important, and when they start to say this is no longer a priority, I think we should all be concerned about that, because what's going to be next then? And that's not to say that domestic violence and sexual assault are the only issues that are community responsibility, and they are the only worthy, you know, funding sources, or the only missions that are worthy of funding sources.
Sure.
There's a lot of them out there. But I think, again, it can play into a little bit about the misinformation. Some people don't understand where that money goes. And again, without meaning any disrespect, but it's a little bit like when people attack Planned Parenthood, not understanding that it's only 3% of their services that actually is related to abortion. And I'm not saying that we should equate that to what service providers for sexual assault and domestic violence do, but it's part of that misinformation, misunderstanding, where people may not understand the far-reaching impact that this money has. You mentioned all the services that people typically provide. They're all necessary.
Right.
And again, if we don't provide them, then what?
Right.
When some of these agencies, a lot of the agencies in this kind of, in this particular movement, started in the grassroots. Right. They sprang from women in a community seeing a need for help, or seeing a need for helping other people.
Sure.
And it started with people offering up their couches and offering up, you know, a spare bedroom, and kind of, you know, saying, if you need something, you can come stay with me. I would like to think that we've evolved from having to utilize people's good graces,
right,
and that as a community we take responsibility,
right,
to make sure that people are afforded a safe place to stay, because ultimately that's all it comes down to.
Totally. Well, and it totally plays into one of the questions that we don't like also, like, why don't they leave?
Yes.
I mean, this is what we're talking about. And so if someone is armed with information, resources, perhaps several days in a shelter, they might be able to remove themselves long enough to have some clarity of mind to come up with a plan that works, mm-hmm, that feels safe, that feels comfortable for them and their family if they have children, right? And then can proceed with an exit route. But when that's not even available,
yeah,
then asking that question, you know, especially when we're pulling money in terms of funding for a really worthy cause. And to your point, yes, there are so many worthy causes. There are a lot. And I mean, it's easy. Like, I took a break from social media today in particular because it takes a lot to advocate, you know,
yes,
and to do advocacy work and to be an activist and to speak out, especially when people don't always agree with you and sometimes they want to attack you. Like, it does take a lot. And I'm okay because I have thick skin and I have a community of people where it's a safe space. Like, I have safe spaces where I can kind of process with people and take a break. I have spirituality and faith perspective that's helpful, and I have really great community, you know, but sometimes you just need to self-care and just kind of take a little time for yourself. So that's a great segue. What do you love to do to kind of, because you don't think about, I hope you're not thinking about sexual assault and domestic violence 24/7. So what do you like to do, Christine, apart from the hard work that you do, that you enjoy? What are some ways that you engage in self-care?
I love to read, I love to walk, I love to do yoga. And I think it doesn't really matter what it is, but I think it's always important for somebody who does this kind of work or any social services field,
sure,
work, to really work very hard at doing the self-care, because I think part of we're our own worst enemies sometimes,
mm-hmm,
because we're always going to want to give.
Right.
And that's the conversation that I always have whenever I get introduced to new people who are coming into this field of work. And I always say to them, you need to start as you mean to go along. Because if you give too much in the beginning, you're going to burn out and then you're no use,
mm-hmm,
to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It's about the longevity, because we need committed people. And in order to do that, you need to practice good self-care.
Yeah.
Vicarious trauma is very real.
Yeah.
And I don't think I never fully stop thinking about it, because of course,
sure,
I do. I recognize my privilege that I go home at night and I have a safe place to stay.
Yeah.
I recognize my privilege that I'm in a committed, respected relationship with somebody who treats me in the manner that I think is appropriate.
Oh, sure.
But I think that also does give me strength,
mm-hmm,
because I understand that there are good people out there. I meet people like yourself, Chidima,
mm-hmm,
who restores that faith in humanity, and that pushes me along.
Sure.
But I need some quiet time some,
yeah,
days, and so I make sure I take my quiet time.
Good. Yeah, no, it's so important to, you know, stay connected and to know who we are too, apart from the work that we do, because a lot of times people find their identity in what they do. And I think that can be problematic, because A, if you stop doing what you're doing, then you may find that you feel like you're just floating and you don't really have roots, or you're not very grounded. But it also means that when you do take a break, then you might feel the same way, you know? And so you're absolutely right, that burnout is a real thing. And so this work is a marathon, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's less of a sprint. And saying, you know, I need to, like I recently, in my role as a volunteer, because I have so much other stuff going down, I was doing about 3 shifts a month, and I recently had to say, I need to go down to 2 because of all what's going on around me. And I struggle, even though I do so many podcasts for y'all about self-care, and I introduce you to cool people that are doing it, it's an area in which I can improve, you know? So I am committed to improving in that area of myself. Because it's so important to take the time that we need, you know, apart from the things that we do. Even when the things that we do, we absolutely love them, and they really fill us up, like fill our tanks up, you know. It is important to kind of unplug from time to time. So I wanted to, before we wrap up, just remind everyone that you don't have to. So I say that we're all in recovery from something and we're all survivors of something. Absolutely. And I believe that to be true, right? Yes. You don't have to have, if this is something that sounds engaging to you and you feel really drawn to this kind of work, there are nonprofit organizations all across this country that provide resources and support for survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence. So a simple Google search will yield massive results for you. There are also organizations that are specifically tied into college campuses. So if you are a student, that might work for you as well. Oftentimes they have people on staff, but then they have volunteers that are students and only students, and so you're not able to do that role if you're not a student. So that might work well for you if you're a student. You do not have to have experienced any specific sexual assault or domestic violence to be useful, to be helpful, because the story really, it's not really about you anyway. It's about being there for the survivor and giving them what they need to make a decision that works for them in any case, whether they decide they want to proceed with the legal system, whether they decide they do not, whether they decide they want to have a sexual assault nurse examination, SANE exam, what Law and Order SVU calls a rape kit, whether they choose not to. You know, whether they choose to stay with a partner or stay in the home or not. So all you get to do is be a vessel and simply be there. And sometimes you're simply a body insofar as you're just there, a part of this person's life for a short period of time. It could be 30 minutes, it could be 5 hours. It doesn't matter, but you're there simply to give them what they need so that they can proceed with their life in a way that works for them. So don't fret about your own personal experiences, because that's not really important in this role. So if you have any questions, you can always reach out to me directly. You all know my email address, chidima@thetypeahippie.com. And I'm so glad that you all were here. And Christine, I'm so glad that this worked. I've been reaching out to her, and it's not on her. It's just we're both busy, and then we both were under the weather, sadly. And I'm so glad that it worked for us to talk.
I so appreciate you. I appreciate you. I appreciate what you do, because I think we need more voices like this.
Thank you.
And I agree with everything you just said. I think to be part of this movement can be very simple. You can just be a listening ear. You can do podcasts.
Yep.
You can donate money.
That's
even
right.
Even $5, you know, whatever. It's not really about that, but it's about just being present.
Totally.
And I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. So, friends, you know what's coming next, which is just reading out of this book. We'll do a couple short ones. Actually, I already read that one. Let's see. All right. Okay, we'll do these two. So it appears to be a young man smoking a cigarette, and he says, "My first year in California went well. I was going to auditions, getting a lot of jobs. I was even on a couple of TV shows. At one point, a kid even asked for my autograph, and I remember how good that felt. It made me feel like I was doing something important. But then I started doing meth. Once a week at first, and only on weekends, and 5 days a week, until eventually I wasn't even able to get out of bed without doing it. I started hanging out with old, washed-out celebrities who just live off their money and think that they're the same person they used to be. I got super skinny. In my mind, I felt like the man. I felt like I was doing better than ever. But in reality, I was just a meth addict. I came back to New York for a bit to clear my head, but I've got to get back to California and start acting again." He's asked, "Do you think you'll do meth again?" The response, "Of course, but I'll keep it under control this time." And then another person appears to be a gentleman and is asked, "What's the hardest you've ever laughed?" And then the response is, "When I got my divorce papers." So at least he has a sense of humor. So, "I honor the place within you where the entire universe resides. I honor the place within you of love of light, of truth of peace. I honor the place within you where when you are in that place in you and I am in that place in me, there is only one of us." So remain blessed, friends. Thank you so much for listening. I can't wait to connect with you. My name is Shadima, also known as the Type A Hippie. Namaste.